history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories that need to be heard. And if we take the time to ask a few questions and listen to the answers, we'll be amazed by what some folks have done for our country. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we go that way, as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, we're going to talk to Billy Mills. Not the legendary runner, although maybe he's pretty fast too. He was definitely fortunate to survive World War II, and we're going to hear that story. Mr. Mills has lived in Modesto, California since before World War II, but you grew up in Wister, Oklahoma. How big of a place was Wister, Oklahoma?
Just a wide place in the road, you might say. A little country town, farm town.
Were you growing up on a farm?
Yes.
You and your brother?
Me and my brother.
You must have had some chores to do.
I did. A lot of chores to do.
Like what? Give us a taste of what life was like as a young boy.
You had to milk the cows, feed the chickens, just miscellaneous stuff.
Were you guys growing some crops there in Wister?
Oh, yeah.
What'd you have?
Oh, nothing spectacular. It was like a self-sufficient farm, in other words. We grew a little bit of cotton, and we grew corn, and we grew produce, garden stuff like carrots and tomatoes and what have you.
Uh-huh. How about okra? Did you grow any okra?
Oh, a lot of okra.
Mmm.
Yeah, that was her favorite.
You still have a taste for that?
Oh, yeah, I do.
Do you pickle your own?
I like it fried. I like it deep fried.
Deep fried is good. I like it every way, about.
Yeah, I do too. But if it's boiled or wet, well, you start to swallow, you don't change your mind.
It's gone. That's a good approach. So you're growing up on the farm in Oklahoma with your brother, milking cows and tending to all that. Do you remember while you're out there doing all those chores, thinking about, hey, someday when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do with my life? This is who I'm going to be?
No, not really. I was just enjoying being a kid.
Uh-huh. Until your family had to pick up and leave, like so many folks from that part of the country. What do you remember about that, how you guys ended up leaving Oklahoma and coming here to California?
Well, there wasn't any work. It was in the Depression time. Mm-hmm. Wasn't any work there. So father farmed. He worked timber, like cutting piling poles and stuff like that. Haul it to Panama, Arkansas. It might have been in Oklahoma, but anyway, it's close to Arkansas line.
Mm-hmm.
And just whatever, you know, to keep the wolf away. I had an uncle lived in Indio, California. He was farming there, so that's where we ended up. Joined him for a while.
You know, people hear about the Dust Bowl and the migration of people from Oklahoma out here to California, and, you know, a lot of folks picture what they've seen in the movies or on television, and a car of some kind loaded up with just about everything you can think of. Was that the reality for you?
That's just about it.
Did the car ever break down on the way out here from Oklahoma?
No, not really. My father, like I said, he cut logs for the sawmills and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Small sawmill, and he ended up hauling a sawmill for their owner to New Mexico. So that paid the way out, you know. We had the one truck, but he built a camper shell on it for his kids to ride in. So that's the way we ended up.
And I imagine you probably had no idea what to expect out here in California.
Well, not really. I was expecting vegetables and stuff like that because it was in contact with my uncle, you know. So that's what they grew in that area was produce mostly.
Yeah.
Dates, and they had the climate to grow corn, you know, the sweet corn, stuff like that. So.
Yeah. So you end up in Indio, and when did you move here to Modesto?
1940 or something like that.
Uh-huh. So you come to Modesto as a teenager. We're talking almost 80 years ago now. How different was this city? We've all seen that famous arch. What does it say? Water, wealth, contentment, health? That's the famous Modesto photo. Is that what greeted you when you got here?
That's right. And there was just a little village at that time. This was all country, out farm country here, mm-hmm. orchards and what have you.
Yeah, now it's a big city.
Now it's a big city.
So you went to Modesto High School. Were you playing any sports or anything in school, or are you too busy working?
Too busy working.
What kind of work were you doing?
Farm work, picking peaches, pruning peach trees, whatever came along.
And you were still in high school when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember how you heard about that?
No, not exactly.
Well, you would end up serving on a ship that had quite a story on December 7th that was bombed by the Japanese on
right.
December 7th at Pearl Harbor.
Right.
But at that time, did you have any ideas of getting in the military at all, or how did that unfold?
Well, Uncle Sam sent me a notice saying I was needed, so I said, okay, Unc.
Yeah.
Then I ended up going to Farragut, Idaho for boot camp, and a month later I was back in San Francisco waiting for a ship.
Had you ever been at sea before?
No. All new.
What was it about the Navy?
Always the water, so, and I figured I'd have a clean bed. As long as I was floating, well, I'd have a place to sleep.
Yeah, and there would be a day where you weren't sure if you were going to keep floating. But
that's true.
At that point, you didn't know that. So you're in San Francisco waiting for a ship, and you didn't know what ship it was going to be.
No.
Did you have a preference? Were you hoping for a big ship versus a small ship?
Oh, I was hoping for a big one.
Tell us what you ended up on.
USS Curtis, seaplane tender, and flagship occasionally.
And some listeners might not be familiar with that type of ship. They know the carriers and the battleships and the cruisers and certainly the tin cans, the destroyers. So with that as a frame of reference, how big a ship is a seaplane tender? What's the whole point of your ship?
500 feet long or something like that, I'm not sure.
527 feet in length.
Yeah, I
know. That's what your official record says, yeah?
Five something.
You talk about a seaplane tender, so your point as a ship is to be out there in the theater supporting the seaplanes, the big PBYs and stuff like that.
Correct. And we had space for them to sleep aboard at times.
The crews from those seaplanes
from the planes,
had
yes.
bunks on your ship.
Right.
And maybe I got ahead of myself. I don't want to skip over your training up in Farragut, where so many World War II sailors came through and trained. Was there any part of that training that was particularly challenging for you or made you wonder what you got yourself into?
Didn't have time to wonder much. They ran us through so fast. We were really busy. Get us out the war.
So when you get aboard this seaplane tender, the Curtis, tell us what your job was on that ship and where you spent your time.
I spent my time in the boiler room. Started out as a fireman first, and then I ended up fireman second, petty officer second class.
And, you know, when people hear fireman, they think your job is to fight fires. Now, that would eventually happen in your case, ironically enough, but your job was to keep those boilers going, right?
That's
keep the
right.
ship moving?
That's right. That's actually the guts of the thing. If you don't have steam, you don't move on those ships.
Yeah, and that's got to be a pretty hot job.
It is hot. No doubt about it.
So take us inside the boiler room of a seaplane tender in World War II. How many boilers are going, and what do you have to do down there to keep them going?
They're oil-fired. We had two boiler rooms, forward and aft. I was in the aft. You had to keep the water in the boiler and the fire going in there without putting out smoke. In other words, oil and air, your air mixture, oxygen mixture, and at the same time keep from putting out black smoke. You heard from the captain if you put out smoke.
So you guys are constantly monitoring that.
Oh, yes.
That balance. And this steam power generated by those boilers is powering the entire ship and everything that's happening on the ship.
Right.
So that's a pretty important job.
Yeah, it is.
How many people were down there with you?
Let's see. When we were underway, there was four, I believe, each shift.
How long was a shift?
Normally 4 hours.
Uh-huh.
Like 8 to 12 and so on and so forth. Sometimes to keep from one person having the same shift where they had what they call dog the shift, you know, and one shift would work 2 hours longer and then the other one two less.
So they'd overlap?
Overlap.
Mm-hmm. So you'd go down there for 4 hours at a time and sweat your tail off because it's so stinking hot down there. I mean, it probably got, what do you think, 120 degrees hotter?
Oh, it probably was 120.
Yeah. Did you lose weight sweating it off?
No, not really. I wasn't very heavy to start with, so I couldn't afford to lose much.
Was doing that every day, is that something that became monotonous, or was there something that kept your attention or kept it interesting for you?
Oh, it was kind of interesting because we were moving from one island to another. We'd following up the task force, and we would have them dropping bombs around us every once in a while. Down the engine room, I'd sound like someone has a sledgehammer against the bulkhead, so that kind of keeps you awake.
Well, yeah, and that's got to be nerve-wracking because the guys on the deck, they can see the planes. They know what's happening. They know if it's close or not. You can't see anything.
Can't see anything.
And you'd probably have no warning that it's going to happen, right?
That's right. Of course, when you know they're dropping bombs nearby before you get the concussion, well, then you know it could happen any time. So.
But what can you do about it?
Nothing.
And if your ship got hit, you're probably not getting out of that boiler room.
Depends on where it gets hit.
Did you think about that? Did you think about, man, I could not see tomorrow?
Oh, I did at times, but I didn't worry about it that much. It's just one of those things you had to do, and had other guys with me doing the same thing. So grin and bear it, I figure.
I guess so. And I bet you got to know those other guys pretty well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, all the engineering department I knew real well.
And I mentioned what your ship had been through at Pearl Harbor. And again, you're still in California. You're not in the Navy yet on December 7th, 1941. But I imagine you served with some guys who had been on the ship at Pearl. Did you hear some of their stories of what they'd gone through there?
Yeah, I did.
What did they tell you?
Oh, it's been so long, I don't know, but it was scary.
Because on December 7th, they had 32 men on the Curtis killed by a bomb, and a Japanese plane crashed onto the deck. The Curtis shot down four Japanese planes, also destroyed a Japanese submarine, and then, of course, was repaired there at Pearl. So that your ship had almost been sunk before you ever got on it.
Right, it did. Yeah.
And so then, as you said, here in 1943 now, you left the Bay Area July of 43, and you're out there, and most of the Pacific battles that everybody knows are still to come. You guys are out there in the Pacific when they take Tarawa, Kwajalein, and Eniwetok, Saipan, Guam, the Gilberts, the Marshalls, the Marianas.
There's a list of the islands.
Yeah, you've got a list here, and your ship would end up with seven battle stars. And so for all of the rest of 43 and 44 and 45, you're at sea that whole time.
We were out 18 months at one time without hitting our actual port.
Wow. I bet that got old.
It did get a little bit monotonous.
What are some of the things you remember about those days? You mentioned, you know, the bombs hitting nearby and everything. Were you aware of all the places you guys were and what was happening around you?
Yeah, we knew what was going on. And we, in between our steaming shifts, while we were doing repair work also, you know, so repairing pumps and cleaning the bilges. And so there wasn't that much spare time. They kept you pretty busy.
Uh-huh. Did you ever get a break? Did you ever get to go ashore anywhere for some R&R?
While we were out there, sometimes, ever so often, they'd load us on a boat and take us to some little island for swimming and a couple of beers.
Yeah.
Of course, there's no drinking allowed on the ship, so nice little break.
Probably didn't last long enough.
No, it didn't.
And what about the big picture of this war? Because all those battles, I mean, you've got your list right here from October of 43 through 1945, all the places you guys were. These are major battles where the Allies are emerging victorious at a heavy cost and advancing toward Japan. Were you aware of that progress? Were you aware of how many people were losing their lives?
I don't know if I really... I knew there was a lot of lives lost, but we didn't have that much news, you know.
And your job is seaplane tender, so these planes are coming in and going out, and you're interacting with those guys every once in a while, I bet. Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned something else, that your ship, the Curtis, at times served as a flagship.
Right.
That means you had the heavy brass on board.
Yeah, various admirals aboard at different times.
Did you ever get to see them? Were you around them? Were you nervous because they were on board?
No, I really didn't see them, you know, because my job was down below.
Uh-huh. Was that a little pressure to keep that boiler room in ship shape while the big boss was on board?
Oh, yeah. That's pretty much ship shape all the time because they expected the big shots in.
Flagship duties for Admiral McCain, father of John McCain, who we all know now, Vice Admiral Fitch and Hoover and Price. for different times, you had Admiral King, Admiral Nimitz, Admiral Halsey, and even two secretaries of the Navy, Frank Knox and James Forrestal.
Yeah, some of those were before my time, though, you know, but yeah. But it was a flagship, or it was equipped to be a flagship.
Yeah, those are pretty much all the biggest names in the Navy in World War II. Halsey, Nimitz, Knox, Forrestal. Yeah,
that's right. They fed good, though, for that reason.
When the Admiral's aboard, the food is pretty good. It's time for our first break. When we come back, we're going to hear about a tragic day on the USS Curtis, that seaplane tender that Bill Mills was on from 1943 until a year after World War II had ended. How did he experience the kamikaze attack that claimed the lives of dozens of his shipmates? And what heroic measures did it take to save that explosive-laden ship from sinking? You'll find photos of Bill and his ship at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.